Okay. Call the meeting to order. First item on the agenda is a review and approval of minutes.
I move approval.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. We're approved. John, any committee reports?
I do. Two commitments made to the committee structure since last we met. On April 22nd, the Alternatives Portfolio Committee met and approved a $150 million commitment to Warwick Partners 3. And then on May 17th, the Opportunity Portfolio Committee met and approved a $150 million commitment to Owl Rock Capital Corporation.
Okay. Great. Michael and Sam, you guys are up. Sam, you're up.
Today, staff in Torrey Cove are recommending a $250 million commitment to Permira Fund 6. This is a 6.5 billion euro global growth focused buyout fund that has a heavy pan-European focus. Today we have co-managing partner Tom Lister and partner Chris Davidson, who's also the head of IR for Premiera, to tell you their story. And as always, afterwards, Torrey Cove and staff will be back up to answer any questions or concerns. Tom?
Good morning, and thank you for having us. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm Tom Lister, co-managing partner of Premiera. And with me is Monica Chase, who is the head of North American Investor Relations. My partner, Chris Davidson, who runs all of our investor relations around the world, is also here today. I thought I'd get started and talk a little bit about the firm, our culture, and our platform. This is a firm that's been around since 1985. I've had my job with Kurt Bjorklund, who's my co-managed partner, who lives in London, since 2008. We started off as four separate country funds. First 11 years of our life as a firm, we're running businesses separately in the UK, Germany, France, and Italy. So we've been in those markets as long, if not longer, than anybody else. 1997, we put the firm together into one pan-European fund. As you might imagine, taking four sets of different cultures, different European partners, and making that successful and work was a real challenge, but is also an important part of the fabric of the firm. Since 1997, we've been investing across Europe in one pan-European fund, and then subsequently, in 2002, we expanded into North America, and in 2005, into Asia. Today, we have 10 investing offices around the world, 6 in Europe, so we cover all the important markets in Europe directly, 2 in North America, 1 in New York, and 1 in Menlo Park. And as I go through my materials, you'll see that we've been a very successful technology investor. And if you're going to run an international technology franchise, you must be in that market. And then businesses in Tokyo and Hong Kong, which have been very successful for us. You should think about us as a pan-European firm with international roots and a very strong culture. I'm now on page 3 of the presentation. And every time I talk about our firm and I talk to groups like yourselves, to me, the most important thing are the 5 or 6 things that set us apart from others. Of course, I'm biased in what I'll say, but I believe that when you look into our record and how we've run the firm, that all 5 of these stand out. We have a very strong track record, generated 23% net IRRs over the life of our time in business. That's going all back all the way to 1985. And our more recent funds have been very successful. One of the things that I'm sure you will have observed is that we raised the 2006 fund, half of which we invested prior to the global financial crisis. The other half of which we invested between 2009 and 12 turned out to be a very successful firm and fund, although, as you can imagine, we faced a number of challenges going through that period, and we both handled those and succeeded very well. That fund has the lowest loss ratio of any of the funds we've ever raised or invested at 3%, which I'm incredibly proud of. I think that I owe to you and our firm owes to you a couple things. One is very good returns. 2 is sanctity and surety of your capital and therefore low loss ratio. The second differentiating point is the global reach. We've built, through indigenous growth in these local markets, very strong networks across the markets in which we operate. We do very well when we compete against other firms in our home market because we have local people on the ground who've been there for a number of years and are very good at differentiating the firm themselves. The next thing is thematic origination. Everything we do is based on sectors. So we invest through five sectors, and we do that on a thematic basis. So we start bottoms up. We look for interesting businesses and interesting themes, and then we work to invest behind those themes as opposed to waiting for somebody to call us and say, I have an interesting deal, and you should compete with a number of other private equity firms. We try to be ahead of the curve, and I think when you look at the investments we've made, we've done that very successfully. Perhaps the best example that you'll all know about is Ancestry.com, which we've owned. We actually just sold it last week. We invested in that business on two secular themes that all of us were more interested in where we came from and how our roots were. And second, that with the advent of DNA testing, that we would be able, as a business, to provide greater visibility to people around the world into where our roots were. Both of those things panned out. We made three times our money in several years in that investment. That wasn't something that you could just wait to get a phone call and say, oh, I have a great idea, the company is X or Y. The next one is perhaps the most important thing to me, which is we run the firm as a dynamic meritocracy. That means that performance results in improved compensation and performance, so it's dynamic. It's not set at the outset, but it changes. Second of all, it's a meritocracy, so it's fair, and it's based on actual results and actual performance. So those for whom of my partners generate outstanding results for you as an investor, they have the chance to advance and become, you know, rewarded differently over the life of the firm. And a distinctive culture. So everybody will talk about a distinctive culture. We, the partners of the business, own the business. We don't have any outside investors. I'm accountable as the co-managing partner really to two constituencies. Yourselves as investor partners, and my partners who own the business. And my job is to make sure I manage and lead that business with Kurt the most effective way for both of those constituencies. And lastly, successful U.S. business and a tech franchise. I came to Premier in 2005 from a firm called Forstmann Little. I came because I looked around at various firms that were successful private equity investors, came to realize Premier was one of the few without a North American business. We've built that business over 10 years. We've invested in roughly 15 companies and generated nearly 30% IRRs on that. And part of that has been a tech franchise that we built starting in 2007. We are the only firm of the non-incumbents in Menlo Park, and I define them those as people who started there, so that would be KKR, TPG, Silver Lake, and Hellman & Friedman, who went into that market, built a business, and have stuck and lasted, and we're very proud of that. If you look at our track record and the deals that we've done, you'll see a number of technology investments. Today, technology represents about 12% of the world's GDP. When we came to North America, that figure was more like 1%. So if you think about the size of the pie from an investing standpoint, that has been really important for us. Those are the five things that if someone said to me, what's different about you and what do you get with Premier that you wouldn't get with somebody else, those are the five things that I would highlight for you. As it relates to the strong track record, and I'll try to dig into each of these as I go along, and please do stop me as we go through this if you have questions. This shows you our track record going all the way back to the country funds in 1985, 23% net IRRs. Every figure I'll show you here is net. That means net of all the fees and all the carried interest. So this is actually what ends up in your hands. We are a euro-denominated fund, but about 45% of our investors are North American. We report all our results in both currencies. We show you the visibility in both currencies, and we have a very sophisticated, I think, and very successful way of managing in our existing portfolio companies that currency risk and exposure. We understand that for you, to satisfy the beneficiary obligations, you not only need excellent net IRRs, but you need cash back. And we've been a very good cash returner over a long period of time. The chart on page 5 shows you the distribution since 2012. So we've returned more than 13 billion euros to our investor partners. And net of the capital calls we've made, it's $8 billion net. So if you're a proportional investor with Primera over a long period of time, you're net ahead in that period, your share of the $8 billion. What kind of deals do we do and what do we look for? I've touched on a few of these in my opening comments. We are thematic investors. We believe that's the most successful way to find interesting opportunities and create outsized alpha for you. We start with a sector vision. The sector leaders, and there are five of them, our sectors are technology, consumer, industrials, healthcare, and financial services. We then look for opportunities that fit into those sector visions, and we try to build relationships and access to those companies so that when those companies are interested in a transaction, we're in a very good position with that. We try to find companies that are off market, off the beaten path, that aren't otherwise obvious to people. Everyone will tell you that. Everyone will say, I try not to participate in auctions. We have been very successful at that. Now, I should say that everything in our world is either implicitly or explicitly for sale. So it isn't as if I can sit here and say we never compete with others. Most often we do, but if we have those advantages at the outset, we do well from a competitive standpoint. And then lastly, we try to transform them into global leaders. So if you look at our businesses, went from the date at which we acquired them to the date at which we monetized them, we've made significant progress in market share, company position, and growth. And that's what leads to our outsized returns and the real alpha that we generate for you. When we talk about our companies, we look for things that have resilient growth. That means that it's not dependent on a cycle or trends that can come and go. Clearly, Kurt and I learned a number of things managing this business into and through the global financial crisis. And if we look at the businesses that we owned during that period, the ones that were most challenging for us were ones that had more leverage than probably was prudent. And second, had more cyclical exposure or more end market exposure. They may well have grown in 2005, 6, and 7, but when the world came to be more difficult, that growth proved to be somewhat transient in that it was driven by cyclical trends as opposed to resilient trends. A great example of this is actually a company that has its North American headquarters here in Portland that we own. It's a company called Doc Martens, shoe business. Everybody knows the brand back from the early 90s. That business has resilient growth in a number of ways, but one of the most important parts of its resilient growth is it's significantly underpenetrated and has been here in North America. So if we can take modest share in this market, we end up generating outsized growth. Now, of course, we're here in Portland for a particular reason, which is that some of the best shoe people from a branding and a manufacturing and a creation standpoint are in this market, and we've done extremely well with that business as a result of that. Entrepreneurial origination. We reward our partners for finding things that aren't obvious to other people. About 68% of what we've done in the fifth fund is primary. That means not bought from another financial sponsor. And about three-quarters of it is proprietary or had limited competition. That really means it wasn't an 8 or 9-person auction in which we sat in a conference room down the hall from somebody else and had our best and final bid on a Saturday night. It's not to say sometimes we don't do that, but we find that we find more interesting, more attractive deals if we do the latter. And then the last point is market leaders. So we try to create stronger market positions, more market leadership, better growth over the course of our ownership period. In terms of where the deals come, so you can see on the right-hand side pie charts, you can see that about 41% of the fifth fund, so that's our current fund that's about 76% invested, is in technology, 26% in consumer, 23% in financial services. Financial services, by definition, is typically a single country business because of regulation. Much of what we do in financial services is in the UK and in Europe. We do not do financial services today in North America. And then relatively equal percentages of industrials and healthcare. In terms of by region, 60% of what we've done is in Europe. 38% is in North America, and the balance is in the rest of the world. Interestingly, that rest of world investment today in P5 is a South African business that's the largest carrier-neutral data center serving the continent of Africa. We found that business as a sector-led development. We worked on a number of data center deals, And one of the CEOs in the UK came to us and said, we should buy this business in South Africa. We don't have an office in South Africa, but we're able to manage that business and find that interesting opportunity as a result of that. I won't go through each of the case studies, but I always find that it's easier to talk to people about real tangible opportunities. I referred to Doc Martens and Ancestry earlier. I'll pick the fourth one, Pharmac. So Pharmac is an amazing company. It's a fish vaccination business. It's based 500 miles north of Oslo. It's a duopoly provider. So the two companies in the business are Merck and Pharmac. What it does is it provides to the farmed fishing industry vaccines so that they're able to both improve the productivity of their crop and be more thoughtful with the way they apply it. So historically, the way fish in fish farming was vaccinated or inoculated from disease was by throwing a bucket of antibiotics into the water. That's both bad for the fish and ultimately bad for the protein supply down the chain. This company provides, using a little TV, if you remember when you're a kid and you had the TV shot, every single fish receives a vaccination to prevent sea lice and a pancreatic disease. The fish farmer's profitability is far greater as a result of this because his or her yield is much better. We were the only people 500 miles north of Oslo rooting around for this based on the sector theme that over time, fish farming would represent an ever-increasing percentage of the protein supply. The nice part about the end of the story is that 3 years into our ownership, we sold the business for 3.3 times our money to a company called Zoetis. That's the Pfizer Animal Health spinoff. And now, Merck and Pfizer are the duopoly providers in this business. The company was growing. It was a market leader. It was off the beaten path. Those are the ideal things that we look for in our investments. The next chart is one I'm particularly proud of. 65% of our exits since 2008 have been to trade buyers. That's important for you for two reasons. First of all, it means that when we sell things and we generate returns, you as a diversified private equity investor aren't necessarily getting a capital call on the other side for what we've monetized. And second, we think that it's the best reflection of the fact that we've built great worldwide businesses. Companies like Zoetis or Tyco or General Dynamics do not buy businesses that aren't well-structured with lots of growth opportunities without good market positions. And the highest praise for what we do over our ownership position is to be able to sell one of those businesses to a trade buyer. They typically pay very good multiples because they want to make sure that they get top companies with good growth and market positions, and whether they pay 12 or 13 times operating profit for the business is far less important to them than the quality of the business that they get.
Excuse me?
Sure.
Sometimes I find it more telling to see how people run deals that didn't go well.
Yes.
So can you tell us about BC?
Sure. So BC is the one company in the P4 portfolio. So it's Borsarchem. It's a Hungarian chemicals business that we acquired in 2006. It suffers from all the things, Katie, that I described at the outset that we tried to avoid and some of the lessons we learned. So it had more cyclical growth than we imagined. We put in hindsight probably more leverage than we should have on it. Its end market exposure was to automotive and furniture. And when the global financial crisis came, it had, its first 2 years of our ownership were far ahead of its plan. And guess what? When November of 2008 came, it was far behind. We protected the company, we worked very hard on the cost structure of the business, and we ultimately sold it for 20% of our original equity invested to a Chinese strategic buyer. In hindsight, I think I would do three things differently. First of all, we should have studied the end markets more carefully, and we should have understood them, and we factored that into our process today. Second, we probably put more debt than we should have on it. And third, operating as interesting as the market sounded at the time, operating in Hungary in the Florent was a complicated matter for us. So, of course, at the time, while Hungary's in the EU trade zone, they have a different emerging market currency, and that created for us a bunch of issues with respect to where we sold our product and where our actual costs were. Is that
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
It's an experience I like not to, to relive. The day, like November 4th of 2008, I'll never forget, the partner responsible for the investment came up to me and said, I just want to let you know that our October sales are down year over year 40%. Imagine that. Yeah. I'm now on page 10. So this gives you the list of the 15 portfolio companies in the fifth fund. They're diversified by geography, by sector. They're performing quite well. There are a number of them that are buy and builds. We find that when you find a platform investment and then you're able to add to that platform investment, you do it typically at lower multiples before you include any synergies for it. And if you successfully integrate it, you end up with a much stronger, better platform. We do a lot of work on the management teams. We think one of the highest, most effective things to do to change the outcome of a portfolio company and the ultimate return on investment is to put into that company senior management who is broader, more experienced, and more capable than the existing company. So I referred to Doc Martens a little earlier. I actually ran into the CEO this morning in the hotel. He's here for the week. He ran the Vans business for VF before he came to Doc Martens. That business was four times as big as Doc Martens, and he is able to think about a North American growth strategy that you wouldn't otherwise have been able to think about if you hired somebody who was less broad, less deep, and less experienced. And we do a lot of M&A. We work to add and build with these businesses because we think that that is attractive from a return standpoint and creates a stronger market position. If you look at our historical record, it has been a very successful place for us to spend time.
Can I ask you a question about that? I'm intrigued at how you're able to buy companies if you have a reputation of changing CEOs and CFOs, because presumably they have a say on whether the building is...
That is a terrific question, and it is one of the things that we wrestle with a lot. Of course, if you arrive in your first management meeting or your first interaction and you show this chart, they say, maybe not you. Okay, so sometimes that's the case. Often we buy from families. Often we buy from corporates where the person in the position at the time recognizes that they're not up to the job, that they're not able for the coming 5 years to build the business. And we're very transparent at the outset. Sometimes we bring the CEO or the senior management with us to the first part of it. Sometimes we acknowledge that we'll give it a year and see what happens, but we may change very quickly. This wasn't something that was part of our DNA, if that's an okay word to use, prior to the global financial crisis. Kurt and I came to understand that there were horses for courses, and that management needed to be upgraded sooner, and we did a lot of that. We got the organization accustomed to that and used to that. And there's no doubt, John, that there are times when we aren't the preferred buyer. We just had this situation from an orthopedic company in France where the CEO said, yes, I acknowledge you have a higher chance to bring us to the United States and grow our business, but I'm for the French incumbent. And you have to say sometimes, okay. I don't think that that means that you should be either not transparent about what you're going to do or not prepared to do for you as the investor partner what's going to create the highest amount of value.
Thanks.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
Let me say, I don't hand this chart out at the first management meeting for the avoidance of doubt. On page 11, this gives you a sense of the senior leadership of the firm. As I said, Kurt and I have been doing this since January 1, 2008. And we will do this all the way through the fund P6 that we're talking about today. We're 52 and 48, respectively. We have no plans to do other than what we're doing today. We love what we do. Jörg Rockenhauser, who runs our German business and has been on the investment committee since 2009, has one of the best track records. Richard Sanders, who co-runs our tech business and sits in London. Benoit Vauchy, who runs our French business. At the end of the day, the five of us who are responsible through a relatively lengthy and very rigorous process to make sure that the companies that we put into the fund that we're talking about are both excellent from a return standpoint and have very good downside protection. In terms of running the business, we run the business with an executive committee of eight senior partners. As I said, the partners own the business. And so we're accountable to our 26 partners, the eight of us, to make sure we do the right things with the business, run it properly. This group does compensation, performance review, strategy, people development. It's my assumption, and then when I talk to investor partners, they always say, we expect you to know how to run the business and run the business effectively, and we think that this group, who's been together for a number of years, does that effectively. In terms of the team, 130 professionals, five sector specializations, three special teams. So we have a financing group, so we have 11 partners and principals around the world that every time we borrow money, the 11 of us work together and look at that to make sure we're getting the best terms, doing it in the most effective and most price-effective market, and manage those capital structures. We have a very good record, and we would have to, by definition, to have a 3% loss ratio in the fourth fund of managing our capital structures. We are not the taker of the last dollar or euro of debt. We typically put a little less debt on the businesses and work to make sure that the equity is both protected and can thrive and succeed. That's especially important when you're buying businesses that require investment. And then we have a legal and structuring group to make sure that we structure these companies in the most effective and thoughtful way and put them in a position where when the strategic comes to acquire the business, they look at this as Zoetis did when they bought Pharmac and say, this is the kind of company that's set up, structured, has the systems in place that I can easily take it and not have to worry about what I'm getting. In terms of our investor base, we have a very stable, very well-recognized, very effective investor base. As I'm sure you know, not all of them like to have their names disclosed on a piece of paper, but just for the, you know, for your benefit, in the sixth fund, our largest investors will be, include the two California plans, CalPERS and CalSTRS, GIC, the Singaporeans, CPP, APG, which is the largest pension plan in the Netherlands, and used to be the largest provider of capital to AlpInvest. The state of Washington, Monica, Chris and I are going this afternoon for our public meeting tomorrow in Washington. Washington is an existing investor, has been with us in P4 and P5. This is a really important list for us. I feel, as I said, a steward of the business both to this group as well as to my existing partners. About 48% of our capital in the fund will come from North American investors. So while we are a European firm, our investor base looked quite similar to what you would see in many, if not most, of the North American firms. And you're welcome, and I encourage people, you can speak to anybody at any of our investors. We have a terrific relationship with them, and we're very proud of them.
Tom, I have a question for you.
Sure.
So having been in the business for a long time, and assuming you guys are super smart, the numbers say super smart, what do you see coming? What's changing? What's exciting? What's terrifying? What's keeping you open?
Can I answer the exciting part, and I'll leave the terrifying part there. First of all, I should say, and people say this a lot, so Kurt and I have split our job in a particular way. People say about him, he's the optimistic one, and I'm the pessimistic one, or I worry, and he thinks about what's coming. What excites me about the business is that there's enormous amount of opportunity to find the companies like the ones I've discussed and described today, capitalize them effectively, give my partners, my younger partners who find these deals, the opportunity to create market leaders and really create world-class companies. And we've done that a number of times, and we're very proud of those successes. This has always been, for as long as I've been doing this, as long as you as a group have been investing in this asset class, a very good governance model. Through all kinds of different periods, all kinds of different challenges, despite what everybody has said over time, the governance model works very well. You provide an amount of ownership to the senior management, you upgrade the senior management, you are accountable and you own and are focused on the business, and you can turn into great world-leading businesses. What we've done with Ancestry, I'm more proud of than, you know, and I can tell you stories like that about many companies. What worries me? A couple things. First of all, there are a couple of exogenous things out in the world today that worry me. One is sort of the leverage levels that exist in China, which is the second largest economy. Well, we have no exposure today in that market. We do have a team in Shanghai. we need to have a team in Shanghai because so much happens in that market. That does worry me from an investing standpoint, and I think you hold us accountable, make sure that we make good choices and price that risk effectively. I worry tremendously about what I would call, and I always say, Monica and I always teach each other, we don't talk about politics when we come to these, but I do worry that we have a system and a structure right now where people have moved to the extremes with respect to the political structure and the political debate, and how one moves that debate, whether you believe it should be further to the left or further to the right, back to a place where it fits within the guardrails. You know, the best leader in Europe for a period of time has now got herself in a very difficult position over a policy that when you thought about doing it, you would never have imagined it would become so inflammatory, if that's a fair way to do it. So that concerns me and worries me. And then third is, you know, you have to sit in the position I sit in and worry about making good investments that generate good return and what your competitors do to you. So I have excellent competitors. In each one of the sectors, we really compete against different people. I worry about that every day. What is Vista thinking about with respect to technology? What is a Catterton or somebody else thinking about with respect to the consumer businesses that they own? That is, you know, an ongoing thing.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Wondering, too, if your perspective as a European fund with a traditional investor base, whether there are advantages to that? Do you think, other than the currency discussion, which I
Europe has always been, if you go back over a long period of time, by some meaningful to some modest amount, depending on which period you pick, a high-returning market. That's partly because it's a multiple market, so it's very different in Italy, France, and the UK, and you can't run a fly-in, fly-out business with respect to that. The second thing I would say about Europe and Europeans going all the way back to the 1500s is that it is, if you have a European business, you can't be a market leader by remaining on your continent or your country. And that was proven by Marco Polo. If you go all the way back to then, he couldn't trade and succeed in his own market without going someplace else. Europeans and European companies are very receptive to and thoughtful about international expansion, and we've played to help that happen. Whereas you can do that in North America, the market itself is big enough that you can be a fundamental North American company and have plenty of opportunity, market share, and profitability. A number of the businesses that we have bought, we've actually bought North American businesses, and we've helped grow them into Europe. Actually, one of the most important things we did for Ancestry, we were able to take the record base that the company had in North America, broadly speaking, but really the United States, and get the Irish, the Germans, the Polish to contribute their records into the system, which made the value of the database far greater. So I think it's much less about the currency than it is about what we can do with these businesses out of a base in Europe to grow them and expand them, and what we can do with North American opportunities that we make them stronger there. I think if you look at our track record, and of course I'll say I'm biased, but I don't think anybody can say they've taken as many North American companies and turned them into European leaders as we have. When a North American portfolio company of ours goes to Germany and they say they're a premier portfolio company, it's a very different opening dialogue than it's been. Let me just briefly touch on P6. So Sam touched on these in his opening comments. What we will do with P6 is more of the same with respect to what we've done in P5 and the second half of P4. All the kinds of companies I've talked about, typically enterprise values of 500 million to 3 billion and equity checks of 300 million to 500 million euros. In terms of terms, we are very focused on this. We understand that sitting in your position as an investor partner and stewards for your capital, that we need to be transparent, we need to be fair, and we need to be thoughtful. We do not charge transaction fees. We do not charge other kinds of fees. Kurt and I, when we took over the business in 2008, we stood up at the 2009 investor meeting and said, we're going to stop charging transaction fees because we're your partner. And that is sort of the mindset we go at this with. We put a lot of capital into this in business and our investments. Fundraising has gone very well this time. There's a kidding with Sam and Andy before, that wasn't the case, and you'll know that in P5. Kurt and I spent about 2 years out on the road raising the capital because things like Pharmac hadn't come so that they were quite as obvious today as they were. I tell people fish farming in Norway is fantastic, and they look at me, kidding. We will have a first closing in June and a final closing in September. For the avoidance of doubt, this is a very important investor partner to me. We spent a lot of time over a long period of time, and we very much like to have you as an investor partner. There will be very few non-P5, non-P4 investors come into this, and this has been, you call it whatever you want, an important thing for us because of your track record, because of your commitment to the asset class. And we, you know, we're very focused on getting the capital in place. As I said, we're 76% invested in the fifth fund, so that means we have three or four deals to go. It has been a slower market the last 6 months than it was at other periods of time, so I don't know exactly when we'll start the next fund, but sometime in the fall or early in 2016.
Any questions?
I have a question, Dave, and this, please understand that you've been very successful at it, and I'd like to know how you do it, because to some degree it works against what I've always thought, and that was in part the result of a real estate professor I had at Harvard Business School years ago who said, this is Davidowitz, who'd been around the block. He said, for example, if you want to be a real estate broker in Manhattan, you make more money if instead of chasing the big deals around the island, you carved a piece of brownstones in the Upper East Side, and nothing happened inside that area that you were involved with because you had more knowledge. You were the source. So, I mean, I looked at this proposal, and you're professing to be the expert in a whole variety of different sectors in Europe, Asia, and North America. Now, you've done it. Maybe Davidowitz's perspective only applies to real estate, which is my own field.
So I think, first of all, it's a really good question. I think you should think of us as a sector investor, and the fact that we have these various geographies is important because it gives us access to ideas. But I always remind our sector leaders and our investment professionals, your geography is simply where you leave your computer the days you're not out looking for investments or working on portfolio companies, and is a field to plant in and produce crops, but is not a reason to be or an existence. So it is very unusual for us to just find something in Italy or just find something in France and invest in it. If you go back to the early 2000s, the firm was different with respect to that. Kurt and I spent an enormous amount of time in the outset, an enormous amount of our investment capital. Remember, we're a business with no R&D and no CapEx, so we only have people in sector talent, sector leadership. I think the other part of the answer to your question is a cultural one. So I said at the outset it's a dynamic meritocracy, and the culture is really important. That's very hard to explain in a paragraph in this form. You have to meet the people, understand the people, and see what they're like. But they're not in it just for the next euro dollar or Hong Kong dollar of compensation. They're in it to create market leaders. They're very proud of what they have created. And if you talk to them, they will start with Ancestry's profit went from 150 to 300 million, and we got into DNA business, not anything. Do we try to accomplish a lot with a relatively small team? Yes, we do. But it's really important to know we have no other business. So many people are multi-asset managers. We are not. We're only in the private equity business. Many people have outside shareholders. Some are publicly traded. Some are not. We are not. So I would say this is our only business. This is our most important business. This is all we have. And to some degree, that is an important defining factor. By the way, I don't think he's wrong with respect to the definition of that. And to some degree, that's what we've done. We've said we're going to pick five sectors. We don't do real estate. We don't do oil and gas. We pick those five sectors, and then we work really hard at them. And it's proved successful.
It's worked.
So far. And we expect on a go-forward basis as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice to see all of you.
Thank you.
start off just a couple of comments that will frame how this fits in the portfolio, what it accomplishes for the program, and answers a couple of key questions, which is why Europe and why a new relationship? Following global financial crisis, staff had a fairly neutral view on Europe, and I characterized what we did there for a number of years as treading water, staying with good managers that we have, but not looking to drastically increase capital deployed there. Last year, in our private equity planning session, we came out of that with a tactical view. I think Mike told you in February or March, we thought Europe was getting more attractive again and wanted to rebuild some exposure there. That's been a concerted theme this year. And in terms of why a new manager, we've had a number of things. Certainly conscious of trying to limit the number of managers and make bigger commitments to the ones that we have. However, in trying to build up this Europe exposure, had a couple things happen this year. One was an existing manager that we liked, but that came to market with a very LP unfavorable term. We did not get there with them and did not bring that forward as a recommendation. Second, it's a very robust fundraising environment right now. A pan-European group that that you all approved a couple months ago. What we ended up with for our final allocation to that fund was about half what was approved just because of excess demand. So I think we've concluded we need this relationship to get the Europe exposure that we want. With that, any specific questions?
So the commitment is $250 million, not euros?
Correct.
That was, and this is something we can obviously talk about, 250 is sort of the average check size. So we're asking for approval sort of in line with the average. Our ultimate commitment will be denominated in euros, so it'll be 225 euros.
Okay.
If it is, I mean, I think it's the view internally. We're happy to be denominating our recommendations in the fund's currency if that's easier.
No, I just wanted to make sure that number wasn't constraining what you really wanted. And
it's in line with its peers in the portfolio.
Okay.
And it at that level, it does get us to a management fee discount that the next step up doesn't occur until 300 million.
Now, having said what I did in the question to Lister, but I believe that we ought to be in Europe. But if we had a strictly European company, they wouldn't have the ability or willingness to say, things in Europe don't look good right now. We'd like to stay out of Europe. Whereas this company has the ability to say, things don't look good in Europe, but things do look good elsewhere.
That's a very good point. It does provide them optionality, and that's why we've historically liked a pan-European model as opposed to country funds, because some European countries, Italy, can go 2 or 3 years where it's just not a place where you want to invest. So the more optionality, the better. And in this case, yes, they can. Europe doesn't look good. They can go to North America. They can go to Asia. If North America looks too pricey, they can concentrate in Europe.
And there are signs with the Brexit Europe as an entity could be in serious trouble.
That is one of the macro risks that's an unknown.
So I love the European waterfall, so that's nice. I mean, this is a stupid question, but just to be very clear, he said that they might not pull any money until 17. So I assume...
Try close.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, I knew it was a stupid question, but it's got to be asked.
Fair enough. And a very succinct answer.
Yeah.
What's the balance between the amount of demand you guys are seeing for these types of funds versus the quality of the opportunities that they think a group like this will see?
Excellent question. Yes. In Europe in particular, since the financial crisis, there's been a lot of turnover in the legacy names. Most groups in here went through some version of restructuring. Some are out of business. Some have come out the other side and look like this firms. As a practical matter, that means that the survivors are the beneficiaries. So there's excess demand chasing the Europe-heavy GPs versus what a comparably sort of pedigree U.S. GP would get today. As Sam said, they've all sort of in line come to market this year with one big exception, which will come next year. And you're seeing a waterfall of, I didn't get the allocation I wanted in this one, I'm going to the next one. It's a bit of a feeding frenzy. Now, you know, to Premier's credit, I don't think that, you know, there's some sales involved with saying that this is an important relationship when they're standing in front of you. But to their credit, they have worked us for a very long time. Sam knows them over a decade from a previous position. I know them over a decade from a previous position. So I think there's some truth to the fact that we were a special sort of new LP and we should be treated well. We obviously are in legals now and we don't even have approval. So I don't want to put the cart before the horse, but the dialogue we've had with them, the guidance as to where we'll come out on allocation has been pretty good. We're very happy.
Okay. Do I have a motion?
Move approval.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Complex in a private equity deal, but more administrative routine matters as part of the ongoing governance here. So as a backdrop, this is a staff recommendation for extending under the terms and conditions existing in our current contract with BCA to do another 2-year extension under those terms. As a quick backdrop, we went through a full RFP process in early 2013 for a real estate consultant, which then ended up in a contract beginning July 1 of 2013 with current PCA. Their first 3-year term is up now, and under the contract provisions of the OIC, 2 2-year amendments or extensions can be provided. The justification is really a twofold. First is try to mitigate the coterminants term limits with each of the consultants within the prior private markets. They do take a number of months to work through. We're going through an RFP right now with a private equity team. Alts and Ops will be working on theirs next, and to layer in that process and more efficiently work staffing bandwidths, you know, to extend on their 2-year contract with PCA. Secondly, we really took a big breather last year in the real estate portfolio, in which we revamped policies and reset our footing as well as the go-forward objectives for the portfolio. That put a bit of the reset button on us being out in the market. I feel like we've just really hit the ground running right now and gaining some pretty good momentum. There's a lot of ongoing research as we pop back out here into the market with a redefined strategy and trying to go longer and larger with more core and income-producing properties. So to that end, really efficiently work our process and harmonize the consultant and ongoing due diligence needs between staff and consulting teams. This 2 years gives us the breathing room and runway to do that best. So with that, I will leave the floor open for questions. And then PCA is here, too, if there's any organizational questions to be addressed that they can best answer.
Good questions. Am I correct that they're paid a fixed fee?
That is correct, on a quarterly basis.
Could you elaborate on 2 versus a 1-year extension? Why a 2-year extension?
Well, in reality, all contracts with the OIC are underneath a 30-day cancelable or terminable contract at will by the OIC. With that in mind, it's expectation that we'll be working with PCA next year to try to restructure both the diligence needs and perhaps underlay a reporting upgrade to into our package. And that's something that we've been working with PCA on for a little while. Need a little more runway to get there, and it'll be part of our ongoing dialogue. Expect that'll take us a good few months to work through while we're concurrently looking at a number of different investment programs as well. So
The 2 years is just stipulated within our current contract, but it can be amended and changed at any time.
I'm trying to weigh, obviously, the value and the hassle factor of changing out consultants versus the desire to get the best and the brightest and the most current thinking. Where do you guys come down on that?
I feel like we have the best synergies amongst PCA and staff right now that we've had in years. It takes a while to rebuild that. Completely agree with the amount of work that needs to be done with an understaffed model and that consulting team to be able to bring diligence to bear to the council with good recommendations. At this point, we want to minimize that disruption, but we do have some more efficiencies I think we can gain out of restructuring our contract. So layer that in appropriately so that we can have the oversight needed not just by the two-member real estate staff, but bring in John Hershey and form the CIO. We probably need the full 2 years in order to start this effort next year.
I was kind of in favor of a one-year extension to keep your feet to the fire, but John thought that it would be done with in one and it would give you an extra year.
A part of it is a balancing act and optionalities, too. It depends on where we want to spend our bandwidth. As I look at it, we can only do so much at one time. So it's trying to maintain a focus both on consulting and working with our ongoing contract and PCA, as well as doing our
I'm fine with either answer, but I'm trying to figure out the logic here. Are we trying to get to a point where we can do an RFP, and you're saying it's going to take us 2 years to get to the point where we can do an RFP, or are you saying you want to avoid an RFP, and it's going to take us 2 years to put the runway in place to continue our relationship with PCA? Where are you on this?
Try to clarify. I'm trying to avoid an RFP today. I don't think that's necessary given that we have contract terms and where we're at within our own life cycle and investment regimen. Going forward, I don't want to give a scripted answer to that question yet for 2 years out from now. I'd like to leave that optionality at the table for further dialogue amongst staff before coming together.
Do we have a policy around incumbency? You're a consultant for X years before there must be an RFP, or what is our current
policy? My understanding is it's a 7-year term limit, so there's an initial 3-year, and the way we've set up the contract is 3-year initial period and then 2 2-year options. For a full 7 years.
And this is our first 2-year option.
Correct. We're at the end
Got
of 3 years.
Okay.
And it does take, a couple of years for the two organizations to learn the portfolio, start moving forward and rebuild. We had, as many of you know, 20-plus years with Nori, a lot of continuity there. And that takes momentum and time to rebuild. This gives us the time to work on that. And it's my understanding, talking with our CIO and John Hershey, that next year this will be a very large endeavor of staff to move forward and continue looking at the contract. But I want to leave that full optionality out there to give us the 2 years that we have currently under the contract provisions.
I favor a 2-year extension because we will see a new treasurer, and having to deal with this immediately after that person takes office, you'd be doing it on less than perfect information.
I'll give the counter argument. I'm tying my successor's hands.
You remind me of my wife, who I love.
She's better looking than you are.